namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. To understand. I'm just going to go to the bathroom. Yeah. While I'm away, can someone read the doing chapter 4, and can someone just read the summary introduction there, and once reading that, then just read through those translations. I'll just be 1 minute. Yeah, a nice loud voice.
This chapter 4, Amrish Maharaj offended by Durvasa Muni. This chapter describes the history of Maharaj Nabhaga, of his son Nabhaga, and of Maharaj Amrish. The son of Manu was Nabhaga, and his son Nabhaga lived for many years in the Gurukul. In Nabhaga's absence, his brothers did not consider his share of the kingdom, but instead divided the property among themselves. When Nabhaga returned home, his brothers bestowed upon him their father as his share. But then when Nabhaga went to his father and told him about the dealings of the brothers, his father informed him that this was cheating and advised him that for his livelihood, he should go to the sacrificial arena and described 2 mantras to be chanted there. Nabhaga executed the order of his father, and thus Angira and other great saintly persons gave him all the money collected in that sacrifice. To test Nabhaga, Lord Shiva challenged his claim to the wealth. But when Lord Shiva was satisfied by Nabhaga's behavior, Lord Shiva offered him all the riches. From Nabhaga was born Amrish, the most powerful and celebrated devotee. Maharaj Amrish was the emperor of the entire world, but he considered his opulence temporary. Indeed, knowing that such material opulence is the cause of downfall into conditional life, he was unattached to his opulence. He engaged his senses and mind in the service of the Lord. This process is called Yukta Vairagya or feasible renunciation, which is quite suitable for worship of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Because Maharaj Amrish, as the emperor, was immensely opulent, he performed devotional service with great opulence, and therefore, despite his wealth, he had no attachment to his wife, children, or kingdom. He constantly engaged his senses and mind in the service of the Lord. Therefore, to say nothing of enjoying material opulence, he never desired even liberation. Once Maharaj Amrish was worshipping the Supreme Personality of Godhead in Vrindavan, observing the vow of Dwadashi. On Dwadashi, the day after Ekadashi, when he was about to break his Ekadashi fast, the great mystic yogi Durvasa appeared in his house and became his guest. King Amrish respectfully received Durvasa Muni, and Durvasa Muni, after accepting his invitation to eat there, went to bathe in the Yamuna river at noontime. Because he was absorbed in Samadhi, he did not come back very soon. Maharaj Amrish, however, upon seeing that the time to break the fast was passing, drank a little water in accordance with the advice of the learned Brahmanas, just to observe the formality of breaking the fast. By mystic power, during Durvasa Muni could understand that this had happened, and he was very angry. When he returned, he began to chastise Maharaj Amrish, but he was not satisfied, and finally he created from his hair a demon appearing like the fire of death. The Personality of Godhead, however, is always the protector of his devotee, and to protect Maharaj Amrish, he sent his disc, the Sudarshan Chakra, which even immediately vanquished the fiery demon and then pursued Durvasa, who was so envious of Maharaj Amrish. Durvasa fled to Brahmalok, Shivalok, and all the other higher planets, but he could not protect himself from the wrath of the Sudarshan Chakra. Finally, he went to the spiritual world and surrendered to Lord Narayan. But Lord Narayan could not excuse a person who had offended a Vaishnava. To be excused from such an offense, one must submit to the Vaishnava whom he has offended. There is no other way to be excused. Thus, Lord Narayan advised Durvasa to return to Maharaj Amrish and beg his pardon.
Sure. Hare Krishna. Thank you. So this pastime of Ambarish Maharaj and very important instructions, of course, in the nature of a pure devotee's relationship with the Personality of Godhead, and how much they are surrendered to the Personality of Godhead, and how the Personality of Godhead thus protects them and loves them. And some of the verses that we hear spoken by the Lord himself in that regard are some of the essential verses of the Bhagavatam itself, which relate not just to pure devotees like Maharaj Ambarish, but the same verses are applicable to the gopis and such exalted personalities and Srimati Radharani. So very, very important section of the Bhagavatam. So text number one, Sukadeva Goswami said, the son of Nabhaga named Nabhaga lived for a long time at the place of his spiritual master. Therefore, his brothers thought that he was not going to become a grihastha and would not return. Consequently, without providing a share for him, they divided the property of their father among themselves. When Nabhaga returned from the place of his spiritual master, they gave him their father as his share. Nabhaga inquired, my dear brothers, what have you given to me as my share of our father's property? His elder brothers answered, we have kept our father as your share. But when Nabhaga went to his father and said, my dear father, my elder brothers have given you as my share of property, the father replied, my dear son, do not rely upon their cheating words. I am not your property. Nabhaga's father said, all the descendants of Angira are now going to perform a great sacrifice, but although they are very intelligent, on every sixth day they will be bewildered in performing sacrifice and will make mistakes in their daily duties. Purport. Nabhaga was very simple-hearted. Therefore, when he went to his father, the father, in compassion for his son, suggested that as a means of livelihood, Nabhaga could go to the descendants of Angira and take advantage of their misgivings in performing jagya. Nabhaga's father continued, go to those great souls and describe two Vedic hymns pertaining to Vaishvadeva. When the great sages, having completed the sacrifice, are going to the heavenly planets, they will give you the remnants of the money they have received from the sacrifice. Therefore, go there immediately. Thus, Nabhaga acted exactly according to the advice of his father. And the great sages of the Angira dynasty gave him all their wealth and then went to the heavenly planets. Thereafter, while Nabhaga was accepting the riches, a black-looking person from the north came to him and said, all the wealth from this sacrificial arena belongs to me. Nabaga then said, "These riches belong to me. The great saintly persons have delivered them to me." When Nabaga said this, the black-looking person replied, "Let us go to your father and ask him to settle our disagreement." In accordance with this, Nabaga inquired from his father. The father of Nabaga said, "Whatever the great sages sacrificed in the arena of the Dakshini Yajna, they offered to Lord Shiva as his share. Therefore, everything in the sacrificial arena certainly belongs to Lord Shiva." Thereupon, after offering obeisances to Lord Shiva, Nabaga said, "O worshipful Lord, everything in this arena of sacrifice is yours. This is the assertion of my father. Now, with great respect, I bow my head before you, begging your mercy." Lord Shiva said, "Whatever your father has said is the truth, and you also are speaking the same truth. Therefore, I, who know the Vedic mantras, shall explain transcendental knowledge to you." Lord Shiva said, "Now you may take all the wealth remaining from the sacrifice, for I give it to you." After saying this, Lord Shiva, who is most adherent to the religious principles, disappeared from that place. If one hears and chants or remembers this narration in the morning and evening with great attention, he certainly becomes learned, experienced in understanding the Vedic hymns, and expert in self-realization. And from Nabaga, Maharaj Ambarish took birth. Maharaj Ambarish was an exalted devotee celebrated for his great merits. Although he was cursed by an infallible Brahmana, the curse could not touch him. So that was a little story about the father of Maharaj Ambarish, who was a very simple-hearted devotee of the Lord. Although being cheated by his brothers, his father gave him a way to earn some wealth, knowing that the sages, instead of giving to Lord Shiva, they gave to him. And Lord Shiva came to reclaim that wealth from the Yajna, but they both said, "No, it is actually yours if you want it." But Lord Shiva appreciated their honesty and truthfulness, and he said that therefore they could have that wealth and in charity, and that and he also explained some transcendental knowledge to Nabaga. So
No,
I didn't see a lot of background to that, but what we see here is that we see that Nabhaga had property, it doesn't say how much property he had. This Nabhaga. Now, I haven't seen that explained in detail in this chapter. So, we'll see if we can... Whatever little clues there, we'll try and pick up as we go. But there's not a lot of information that I've seen in this chapter or elsewhere about that. King Prickett inquired, O great personality, Maharaj Ambarish was certainly most exalted and meritorious in character. I wish to hear about him. How surprising is it? It is that the curse of a Brahmana, which is insurmountable, could not act upon him. Sukadeva Goswami said, Maharaj Ambarish, the most fortunate personality, achieved the rule of the entire world, consisting of seven islands, and achieved inexhaustible, unlimited opulence and prosperity on earth. Although such a position is rarely obtained, Maharaj Ambarish did not care for it at all, for he knew very well that all such opulence is material, like that which is imagined in a dream. Such opulence will ultimately be destroyed. The king knew that any non-devotee who attains such opulence merges increasingly into the material nature's mode of darkness. So, so basically, Prabhupada summarizes his purport saying that thus, for the non-devoted, material opulence is a disqualification for spiritual advancement. So it wasn't a disqualification for Maharaj Prickett because he wasn't going to become bewildered or attached to such opulence. So the entire world consisting of the seven islands. He achieved that rule. It says that, but it doesn't say how. But anyway, Maharaj Ambarish was a great devotee of the Supreme Personality of Godhead Vasudev and of the saintly persons who are the Lord's devotees. Because of this devotion, he thought of the entire universe as being as insignificant as a piece of stone. And of course, here, this verse, these verses, text 18 to 20, often quoted, you know, Prabhupada says sometimes he says that, you know, you can take up one item of devotional service of the nine different processes, or two or more, or all of them, at least one. But sometimes he says you can take up all of them, like Maharaj Ambarish. So this verse here is quoted. But especially this first line, Savai Manaha Krishna Padara Vindaya, that, you know, he fixed his mind upon the lotus feet of the Lord. You know, that is the secret in spiritual life, that we engage all our senses for the purpose of fixing the mind on the Lord. Even one of the senses, especially the mind, not fixed on the Lord, can drag us back down into the material world. But I'll read this. These verses are very nice. Savai Manaha Krishna Padara Vindayo. Ujamsi Vakunta Gananunvanave Karo Hare Mandira Majana Rishu Shutim Chakrachuta Satkatahodae Ukunda Lingalaya Dashine Rishu Tadbricha Gatraspase Ga Sangamam Kranam Chatat Pada Saroj Sharabe Shimat Lasya Rasanam Tarapite Pado Hare Chitra Padanu Sapane Shiro Rishikesha Pada Bivandane Kamam Cha Dashe Natu Kama Kamyaya Yato Tamasloka Janasraya Rati. Maharaj Ambarish always engaged his mind in meditating upon the lotus feet of Krishna. His words in describing the glories of the Lord, his hands in cleansing the Lord's temple, and his ears in hearing the words spoken by Krishna or about Krishna. He engaged his eyes in seeing the deity of Krishna, Krishna's temples and Krishna's places like Mathura and Vrindavan. He engaged his sense of touch in touching the bodies of the Lord's devotees. He engaged his sense of smelling the fragrance of Tulasi offered to the Lord. And he engaged his tongue in tasting the Lord's prasad. He engaged his legs in walking to the holy places and temples of the Lord, his head in bowing down before the Lord, and all his desires in serving the Lord. 24 hours a day, indeed, Maharaj Ambarish never desired anything for his own sense gratification. He engaged all his senses in devotional service, in various engagements related to the Lord. This is the way to increase attachment for the Lord and be completely free from all material desires. Purport. In Bhagavad Gita 7.1, the Lord recommends Maya Shakta Manapata Yogam Yunjan Marasaya. This indicates that one must execute devotional service under the guidance of a devotee or directly under the guidance of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. It is not possible, however, to train oneself without guidance from the spiritual master. Therefore, according to the instructions of Srila Rupa Goswami, the first business of a devotee is to accept a bona fide spiritual master who can train him to engage his various senses in rendering transcendental service to the Lord. The Lord also says in Bhagavad Gita 7.1, Asamsayam samagrammam yitagyasyasi tachtrinu. In other words, if one wants to understand the Supreme Personality of Godhead in completeness, one must follow the prescriptions given by Krishna by following in the footsteps of Maharaj Ambarish. It is said, Hrishikena Hrishikesha Sevanam Bhakti Ruchate. Bhakti means to engage the senses in the service of the master of the senses. Krishna, who is called Hrishikesh or Achyuta. These words are used in these verses. Achyuta sat kathodaye, Hrishikesha pada bivandane. The words Achyuta and Hrishikesh are also used in Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavad Gita is Krishna Katha spoken directly by Krishna, and Srimad Bhagavatam is also Krishna Katha because everything described in the Bhagavatam is in relationship with Krishna. We see how Srila Prabhupada has shown us how the verse 7.1 of the Bhagavad Gita This is expanding that teaching. You know, Krishna says, just hear from me, Arjuna, how by fixing your mind upon me, you can know me in full. Yeah, you know, so if one wants to know the absolute truth in full, Krishna says, just hear that from me. So one has to take shelter of Krishna to know the absolute truth. And that's Mad Ashraya. Take shelter of me. And Mad Ashraya, or Mad Ashraya, also means of, or one who is my representative, the devotee, either one. But one cannot understand the absolute truth in full if one doesn't take shelter of Krishna or his representative. So if one doesn't know Krishna, by hearing from him directly or through Parampara, he cannot know the absolute truth. And when then in the Bhagavad Gita, when one takes shelter of Krishna or his representative, the spiritual master, one learns how to engage one's senses in the service of the master of the senses. So that one learns that. And only by that devotional service, and that is called bhakti, you know, using one's senses to serve the master of the senses, that's called bhakti itself. So the spiritual master trains one in bhakti. And that's just an expansion of what bhakti means. Bhakti is active engagement. If one is not actively engaging one's senses favourably in devotional service, one is not doing bhakti. That's what bhakti is, using one's senses engaged in the service of Krishna. Bhakti is not inactivity. That's not in its definition. In fact, the very definition of bhakti is activity, favourable activity of the senses in devotional service. So that's the training. Then you can know the absolute truth. Because bhakti, by bhakti or love, Krishna reveals himself, the absolute truth reveals himself. As a person, otherwise he would not reveal himself. Not reveal himself means that understanding Krishna means Krishna has revealed himself. If you understand Krishna, means that Krishna is revealing himself. You can't understand if Krishna doesn't reveal himself. You can't understand him. What you do understand is not Krishna. It's said that Vishwanath Chakravarti, the cause, for instance, you know, Krishna's colour is described as bluish, you know, blackish blue. Vishwanath Chakravarti, the cause, says that actually that colour doesn't exist in this material world, Krishna's colour. So you can't see it. You can't imagine it. You can't see it. The only way you can see that colour is when you have prema, and then you can see Krishna's colour, which otherwise doesn't exist in this material world, a bhakti. So you can't even see his colour, his form, you know, what to speak of his personality, what have you, without bhakti. And that means our senses engage loving service. That's the mystery. And so we see here that Maharaj Ambarish has engaged all of his senses and mind 24 hours a day in the service of the Lord. That is his only engagement. Now, in performing his prescribed duties as king, Maharaj Ambarish always offered the results his royal activities to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, who is the enjoyer of everything and is beyond the perception of material senses. He certainly took advice from Brahmanas, who were very faithful devotees of the Lord, and thus he ruled the planet Earth without difficulty. So it says here, the Shastras enjoin that even though a Brahmana may be well versed in the occupational Brahminical duties and may be very well learned in Vedic knowledge, he cannot give advice as a guru until he is a Vaishnava. It's interesting, isn't it? You know, so, you know, the Brahmana, probably speaking, they're not actually a guru unless they're a Vaishnava. Although you tend to think of Brahmanas, people tend to, you know, treat Brahmanas, you know, Guruji, like that. But if they're not Vaishnava, they're Vipra. You know, they've got knowledge, but they're not guru. And Maharaj Ambarish took advice from Brahmanas who were pure devotees of the Lord. For ordinary Brahmanas are merely learned scholars or expert in performing ritualistic ceremonies and not competent to give advice. So, because, you know, in ISKCON, we should follow that. It's not just because a devotee is a brahmana or initiated and they're intelligent and know so many things that they're necessarily the leaders should take advice from such persons. They actually need to be pure devotees as far as possible. Really good quality devotees. Because I've told different stories, but I won't go into them. But we do see how sometimes even devotees in ISKCON, Brahmanas, advising management, somehow they've all got together and come up with different schemes which, you know, when you look back at it in retrospect, it's sort of fostering the prestige of the temple, which ultimately fosters their prestige. It ends up a disastrous waste of money, you know, resources and men. So many times we've seen that sort of scenario. But you know, pure devotees, they wouldn't make decisions which are bolstering their prestige, and they wouldn't make that mistake. And but those who have a tinge of that desire for prestige can waste a lot of money and a lot of manpower chasing that. Even their, you know, initiated Brahmanas in ISKCON. And we've seen that. So you know, you really want good quality, unmotivated devotees who love Prabhupada and what he wants to do, and that's their motivation. In modern times, there are legislative assemblies whose members are authorised to make laws for the welfare of the state, but according to this description of the kingdom, Maharaj Ambarish, the country or the world should be ruled by a chief executive whose advisors are all devotee brahmanas. Such advisors or members of the legislative assembly should not be professional politicians, nor should they be selected by the ignorant public. Rather, they should be appointed by the king when the king, the executive head of the state, is a devotee and he follows the instructions of devotee brahmanas in ruling the country. Everyone will be peaceful and prosperous. When the king and his advisors are perfect devotees, nothing can be wrong in the state. All the citizens should become devotees of the Lord, and then their good character will automatically follow. And Prabhupada quotes that verse 5.18.12 from the Srimad Bhagavatam. Of course, in New South Wales, legislative assembly last week, they've been legalizing abortion. You know? And thinking that they're, you know, so that's a great
progress.
What's that?
Great progress.
Yeah, great progress towards hell. that's a result that, you know, if you've got politicians who, the people who are paying them are lobbying them to get these demoniac rules brought in, they will get them brought in to keep their job, to keep their money, their perks. So, and if the ignorant public decide they want it, then they will do it, even if it makes no sense. So, you know, basically they've legalized the murder of unborn, children within the womb. You know, that's intelligence. And they can't see that they're doing something wrong. And, you know, citizens under the guidance of a Krishna-conscious king will become devotees, and then there will be no need to enact new laws every day to reform the way of life in the state. If the citizens are trained to become devotees, they will automatically become peaceful and honest. If they're guided by a devoted king, advised by devotees, the state will not be in the material world but in the spiritual world. All the states of the world, therefore, should follow the ideal of the rule administration of Maharaj Jambarish as described here. If the king is a devotee, advised by pure devotee brahmanas, you won't have the abortion problem. You won't have a whole lot of unwanted babies that people want killed. Oh, this baby's a nuisance, you know. They'll all understand the value of life, the nature of the soul within the body, and duty, and karma, and they wouldn't even consider doing such a thing. Because they're, guided by rascals, then, these babies that are born of illicit sex life are just a botheration that should be killed. And so, they can't, you know, if they don't legalize abortion, then they just do it in the backyard abortion. It'll just happen anyway. They can't stop them, you know. So, very simple solution. In desert countries where there flowed the river Sarasvati, Maharaj Jambarish performed great sacrifices like the Ashwamedha Yajna. And thus satisfied the master of all yajnas, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Such sacrifices were performed with great opulence and suitable paraphernalia with the contributions of Dakshina to the Brahmanas, who were supervised by great personalities like Vasistha, Asita, Gautam, representing the king, the performer of the sacrifices. So Prabhupada explains that in Kali Yuga there's a scarcity of the Jagnika Brahmanas, you know. So therefore, in Kali Yuga, the sacrifice recommended in the Shastras is Sankirtan Yajna. Right. Instead of spending money unnecessarily on performing yajnas impossible to perform in this age because of the scarcity of Jagnika Brahmanas, one who is intelligent performs Sankirtan Yajna. Without properly performed yajnas, there will be scarcity of rain. So it's essential. Because of this scarcity, no food grains will be produced and there will be famines. It is the duty of the king, therefore, to perform different types of yajnas, such as the Ashwamedha Yajna, to maintain the production of food grains. The Brahmanas and Jagnika priests should be sufficiently paid for their expert service. This payment is called Dakshina. Ambarish Maharaj, the head of the state, performed all these yajnas through great personalities like Vasishtha, Gautama and Sita. Personally, however, he was engaged in devotional service as mentioned before. Savai Manaha Krishna Padada Vindayo. And of course, sometimes Prabhupada would quote that, Savai Manaha Krishna Padada Vindayo, that his mind is always fixed upon the lotus feet of the Lord, because it's understood that any person whose mind is fixed upon the lotus feet of the Lord, then all his senses, which are servants, subordinate to the mind, they'll also be engaged. So just that one sentence is enough. So this is interesting, that actually it says, personally, he was engaged in devotional service. So Maharaj Ambarish is a, you know, we've read about Bali Maharaj, who is famous for what? Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnushmaranam, Atmanivedanam. Yeah. He's famous for Atmanivedanam in its pure sense. Atmanivedanam is very rare because of its difficulty to execute. You know, to surrender everything. Atmanivedanam means to, you know, surrender oneself and everything related to oneself. You know, body, mind, soul, possessions to the Lord. And Bali Maharaj is an example of that in its pure sense. What's more rare is that when that Atmanivedanam is performed along with an affectionate relationship with the Lord, such as servitorship, friendship, parental love, conjugal love. So therefore, Ambarish Maharaj, he's an example of Atmanivedanam in Dasya Ras. Therefore, you see the distinction between Bali Maharaj and Ambarish in that Ambarish Maharaj, basically his, constant engagement is serving the Lord with all his sense. That's his only business. He doesn't have any other business. Although he's the emperor of the world, he just utilizes that whole task as a way of pleasing the personality of Godhead. He's performing these yajnas because that's what needs to be done. You know, you need to do that if you're for the country, because you need the rains, the food, the prosperity, the happiness, the citizens, everyone good. Whereas Bali Maharaj, to the same degree, his business is not just serving the lotus feet of the Lord, 24 hours a day with his mind and senses and like that. He became, Bali Maharaj, one of the Mahajans, pure devotee of the Lord. But the loving service of Ambarish Maharaj is on a higher level and of more. And his relationship with the Lord is of much more primary significance than Ambarish Maharaj. And Rukmini In Dwarka, Rukmini Dwarka is an example of Atman Vedanam in conjugal relationship. And similarly, you know, there's Atman Vedanam can be there. So, you know, therefore, there is a slight difference in the way that Maharaj Ambarish executes his ruling over his worldly empire as compared to Bali Maharaj ruling over that part of the universe, and later he becomes Indra and rules over the heavenly planets. There's a little distinction there.
Is the commentary by Acharyas?
What's that?
Is that a commentary by Acharyas?
Yeah, that's in the Acharyas talking about discussing Atman Vedanam from Nectar Devotion. You know, Atman Vedanam is one of the items of Atman Vedanam is one of the items of 64 items of devotional service. Is in deity worship, when we worship the deity with 64 items, surrendering oneself is one of the items as well. And then Saranagati. Saranagati is also surrender. But Saranagati is a little distinct in that one is feeling that I am a surrendered soul to the Lord. So again, in one sense, you know, it's described that Bali Maharaj, you know, he surrendered everything to the Lord, but he's not as much in the mood that I am the, you know, fully 100% subservient to the service of the Lord. As Ambarish Maharaj is. Ambarish is, you know, like in that mood. The Acharyas give this example. It's like, you know, one keeps a cow. So a cow has that mood of surrender that, you know, it just goes wherever the master goes. Oh, the master's brought me here, I'll eat here. The master's brought me here, I'll eat here. And here I can drink here, and I get a pat here, and go home now. We, like, you know, we get milk now. So completely surrendered to the will of the Lord. So Saranagati is like that. There's just where the Lord takes one, you know, one is going. That's Ambarish's, you know, in that sort of mood, Saranagati. So again, there's a slight... And that's because of his... you know, in that mood of dasyaras as well. Whereas, you know, Bali Maharaj is also engaged in the service of the Lord. There's a little distinction that not as just following the will of the Lord. He, you know, he may still have a significant agenda in the way he does things and rules and how things should be done. Whereas, you know, Ambarish Maharaj is more subservient to the will of the Lord, like that. There's a slight distinction. That's the difference between Saranagati and Atman Vedanam, like that. So, you know, whereas the cow, you know, may, you know, is completely surrendered to the master in one sense. That's the example the Acharyas give. But, you know, the master may have other servants who are, apart from the service they're doing, they also have their agenda. So they're fully, you know, surrendered to their service, but they also have other things going on. Whereas a cow just has the master. There's nothing else beyond what the master wants from, sort of thing, in that sense. So this is, you know, a little difference. And we see this also in the way that when Ambarish Maharaj is attacked by Devasa Muni, he makes no attempt at all to protect himself. You know, he's just literally at the will of Krishna. Yeah?
Prabhu, the other day I was hearing from Gurujan Prabhu.
Mm-hmm.
He said, he was talking about Sharanagati, and he said that Sharanagati is actually even not exactly devotional service, but it is a gateway to devotional service, where first thing you have to do is surrender yourself. And then when you start you're doing a service in that mood, then you reach that devotional service platform.
Well,
Atmanivedanam is actually
a
bhakti itself.
Yeah, so Atmanivedanam is, you know, one of the items, one of the limbs of, you know, bhakti. So, so what you were reading that in?
Just in a lecture.
He was speaking in a lecture. So for instance, Saranagati, right? So we know this from six kinds of Saranagati, Anukulasya, Sankalpa, Padikulasya, Vajanam, Rakshishyatiti Vishvasho, Kaptritpe Varnanam Tata, Atma, Nikshepa, Karpanye, Sabidha Saranagati. The six divisions of surrender are the acceptance of those things favourable for devotional service. Right, so these things promote devotional service. The rejection of unfavourable things. The conviction that Krishna will give protection. So surrender to the, you know, protect. Acceptance of the Lord as one's guardian and master. Full surrender, self-surrender. And as it says, Atma Nikshepa. Or, you know, Atma Nikshepa can also, or self-surrender can also be Atma Nivedanam. And humility. And so you see that this full surrender to the will of the Lord is under that heading of broad heading of Saranagati. So, in other words, by full surrender, by Atmanivedanam, one can come to the platform of Saranagati. And so, you know, so, you know, the third one, basically, a devotee must be firmly convinced that Krishna will give him protection. No one else can actually give one protection. And being firmly convinced of this is called faith. This kind of faith is different from the faith of an impersonalist who wants to merge into the Brahman effulgence in order to benefit by cessation of repeated births and deaths. A devotee wants to remain always in the Lord's service. In this way, Krishna is merciful to his devotee and gives him all protection from the dangers in the path of devotional service. So we see that actually Devasa Muni, he meditated in an impersonal way for his own salvation, and therefore not having that firm faith in Krishna, whereas Ambarish had firm faith that just by serving Krishna he'd be nicely situated in the path of devotional service, and that's all the protection he needs. The fourth one, the devotee should accept Krishna as the supreme maintainer and master. So not only one is confident that one is protected by just serving Krishna, but you know, one is maintained, that this is the best master, you know, to maintain. Everything will be done as well. I don't need to be protected by a demigod. He should depend only on Krishna, considering him the only protector. Within the three worlds, he has no protector, maintainer other than Krishna. Ambarish was like that. Apart from Krishna, there's no one else who can protect me. And self-surrender means remembering that one's activities and desires are not independent. The devotee is completely dependent on Krishna, and he acts and thinks as Krishna desires. That's self-surrender. One's mind, he's thinking as Krishna would like me to think, you know, desiring as Krishna would like me to think, engaging oneself as Krishna would like one's self and senses to be engaged at this. So self-surrender, always, you know, surrender to the will of the Lord. And sixth, the devotee is meek and humble. This, he quotes his verse, Bhagavad Gita 15:15. I am seated in everyone's heart, and from me come remembrance, knowledge, and forgetfulness. So that's, I think, does he mention Hrishikesh there? That verse, I'm not sure. Prabhupada sums it up that when the living entity is fully surrendered, he is under the direct protection of Krishna, and Krishna gives him all intelligence by which he can advance in spiritual realization. Krishna causes his devotee to forget material activities, and through the agency of Maya, Krishna causes a non-devotee to forget his devotional service to the Lord. All right, now, that fifth principle, Atma Nivedanam, or as we saw, Atma, you know, Nikshepa. Again, in the Chaitanya Charitamrita purport, it describes self-surrender means remembering that one's activities and desires are not independent. The devotee is completely dependent on Krishna, and he acts and thinks as Krishna desires. Or in the preface to the Chaitanya Charitamrita, it's put like this: to have no interest separate from the interest of the Lord. So they all come under the heading of this Saranagati. And in the Sri Hari Bhakti Kalpa Latika, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati quotes this, that the definition, the iconic definition of Atma Nivedanam, the attainment of the desired goal of the devotees is called Atma Nivedanam. It is achieved when their bodies are fully surrendered to Sri Krishna and they are totally devoid of the mentality of I and mine. I belong to Krishna. Everything that is mine belongs actually to Krishna. Atmanaveda. So, you know, not having an interest separate from the Lord, and what that comes down to is, I am Krishna, myself is Krishna, and everything I have is Krishna's, and everything, my interests are for Krishna's, like that. So that's Atmanavedanam. And that's an item of that Saranagati. Now, in the when we did the Bhakti Shastri and we were studying Nectar Devotion, we considered these points in our handbooks. You remember that? That surrendering everything to the Lord, Atmanavedanam, versus being a surrendered soul, Saranagati, the two are closely related, but there is some subtle difference. A, Atmanavedanam means that one is surrendering his Atma to Krishna. Right? Bodily attachments, mind, soul. An example is Bali Maharaj. Saranagati means I am the property of the Lord. Not that I'm surrendering myself to the Lord, but I am the property of the Lord. As such, the relationship is more intimate. And the example, you know, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, you know, my home, my family, you know, it's all yours. You know, it is yours. You know, the person is a surrendered soul. Everything is Krishna's. Not that, you know, this is mine, but I'm surrendering it to you. Now, this, in the Nectar Devotion, in chapter 6, we see that one of the items, 29, or if you're looking at the, out of 64, it's 49, that one should offer everything to the Lord. Right? This is called the 49th limb, is Atmanavedana, indicates the devotional mood of complete self-surrender. And there again, not just the jiva soul, but Atma also indicates both the concept that I am this material body and the concept that this body and its possessions are mine. These two concepts, one should Nivedana, surrender to the lotus feet of Krishna. That was Jiva Dharma. Yeah. So the first part, one should surrender everything to the Lord, and in Jiva Dharma, explaining that particular section, that sentence from the Nectar Devotion, is saying that, you know, I am mine. Okay. Now, so, let's see. shine. Get another couple of quotes that illuminate that distinction. Now, again in the notes, here, this Saranagati it's in the 11th chapter of Next Devotion. It's in the section of Atmanivedana, but it is described in the Saranagati. Full surrender, therefore, means not only surrendering oneself as a spirit soul, but also surrendering one's mind and body to the service of the Lord. And then this Prabhupada says this quote about Bhaktivinoda Thakur, who is this example of Saranagati. So the Bhaktivinoda Thakur has sung a nice song in this connection. While offering himself as a fully surrendered soul, he said, "My mind, my household affairs, my body, whatever is in my possession, my dear Lord, I offer to you for your service. Now you can do with them as you like. You are the supreme possessor of everything, so if you like, you can kill me, or if you like, you can give me protection. All authority belongs to you. I have nothing to claim as my own." That's Saranagati and songs like that. Now, in Nectar of Devotion, right, and Prabhupada also quoting, as Srila Bhakti Siddhanta did, the Hari Bhakti Viveka. So Prabhupada in Nectar of Devotion, chapter 11, he says, "In the Hari Bhakti Viveka, there is a statement regarding how one can offer his body in self-surrender. There the devotee says, 'My dear Lord, as a souled animal has no need to think about its maintenance and sustenance, so, because I have given up my body and soul unto you, I am no longer concerned with my maintenance and sustenance.' In other words, one should not bother about his personal or family maintenance or sustenance. If one is actually surrendered in body and soul, he should always remember that his only concern is to be engaged in the service of the Lord." And Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, which gives the essential verse that this is coming from, says, "Offering the body as Atma is illustrated in Bhakti Viveka. Just as one does not worry about an animal that has been sold, one should offer this body to the Lord and be disinterested in its maintenance." So as you can see, that level of Saranagati, one may say, "Yes, I've surrendered this house to Krishna. I have surrendered my family to Krishna," and you know they'll do so many programs there and so much prasad and everything like that. Such a person may also engage in the hard struggle to maintain themselves. Whereas the more advanced one is in the Saranagati, saying, "I'm just going to serve Krishna." And Krishna will maintain everything somehow or another, which is what Prabhupada did. I mean, Prabhupada basically maintained, you know, they were spending something like $60,000, you know, dollars a month, you know, on the various temples, you know, and he never ever made one endeavor to go out and, "How am I going to maintain this?" He got up, he translated his books, he made sure the prasad was being done, the deities were being worshipped, and that's Saranagati. You cannot find an establishment in this world like, you know, the Crown Casino from James Packer. I mean, he's going out of his mind trying to run that place, you know, he's having to sell his shares to get rid of the anxiety, you know, they've got billions of dollars and they're still worried, "How will I maintain, you know, my business and, you know, So this Saranagati, that there's so much confidence in Krishna, that that's okay. This is all Krishna's. I'm just a little servant of Krishna. This ISKCON, this is Krishna. You know, this ISKCON is Krishna. It's not different from Krishna. You know, it is going on. I'll do my little service, and Krishna will look after everything. So Saranagati is, a little more intimate,
yeah.
and like that. Surrender is a mood of our love, you know, our loving service for Krishna. When our attachment, you know, to Krishna and our understanding of Krishna is there, we can surrender. We can't surrender without some understanding and attachment for Krishna. That's, we cannot do any apanavana. And when there's such a, one can experience the reciprocation with Krishna and reciprocate with Krishna, that, you know, as Bhaktivinoda Thakur is saying, that I'm just going to serve you, and if you kill me, then that's your will. But my love is that I'm not going to try and do anything, you know, for my own self-interest. I just want to do everything for your interest. Like that. That's his love for Krishna. I just want to be doing things for your happiness, like that. But he's also understanding that the Lord is so loving in reciprocation with his devotees, Bhakta Vatsala. They're part of his songs of surrender. The Lord will reciprocate with them. So, you know, it is a level of the loving transaction that the devotee is on, Saranagati. Being a level of love of God means it's a level of bhakti. There is Saranagati, we read the six items favourable for bhakti, favourable for surrender, or, you know, full contribution to, you know, bhakti, like that. So in that sense you can say those six items of Saranagati, they are very favourable to devotional service.
Mm-hmm.
And devotional service that will then, all the things that you're doing to practice devotional service, to increase your devotional service, you'll advance very quickly when those six items of Saranagati are there. So in that sense, we can say your bhakti will come by doing these six items of Saranagati. But those six items, when the bhakti comes and it's mature, it comes as Saranagati. That is the bhakti. That is the flavour of the bhakti. That is the level of the bhakti. You see what I mean? So the end result of including things, in order to get bhakti, we do the things which the Saranagati, those six items of Saranagati, to get bhakti. When you get bhakti, you have Saranagati. That is the bhakti. It's bhakti with full surrender to the will of the Lord. You know, it is bhakti with which a more intimate form of surrender. See, if Atmanivedanam is one of the nine limbs of bhakti, and Saranagati is a more intimate form of Atmanivedanam, which is one of the nine limbs of bhakti.
Yeah. But in order to get there, you still do Sharanagati first.
You do Sharanagati, yeah. And if we practice them, it matures into Sharanagati. So, you know, to get bhakti, you practice bhakti. To get Sharanagati, you practice Sharanagati. So in one sense, we might say that in the beginning, we're not properly performing bhakti because, you know, there's so many material modes of nature and so many, you know, we're not on the transcendental platform, you know. But, so we might say, you know, sometimes Prabhupada uses that term and says, oh, it's not real bhakti. You know, bhakti real, proper, comes. No sex desire and, you know, this and that. Transcendental. But actually, it's the green mango. It is bhakti. It is bhakti proper, but it's the apprentice version of the real thing.
Mm.
It's the real thing, but it's the apprentice version of it. That's all.
Mm.
So, in the same way that... so, you know, when Prabhupada gives the example of the young girls getting married in India and they go to the home of the husband and they learn how to do some service and develop love. So it's by practicing those things which foster love by which love comes. So it's not real love in the beginning between the young girl and the husband who's 10 years older than her and what have you. You know, it's not real love, but it becomes love, but you can't get that love without practicing the items of love. So it's the apprentice sort of version of it, but and then it comes naturally. Now, so we're talking about Atmanavedanam, and when we talk about Atmanavedanam, you know, we should also understand that if we talk about Atmanavedanam, we can also be talking about Saranagati, because that is also Atmanavedanam, but just with a little bit more intimacy there. So, again, Jivadharma. Summarizing many of these different quotes from the Acharyas and our Shastras, he says, this Bhaktivinoda Kaur says, Atmanivedanam is the ninth limb of bhakti. It is the complete surrender of the pure mind, body, and words to Sri Krishna. The hallmark of this limb is that the devotee gives up all types of endeavors for himself and applies himself solely for the sake of Sri Krishna. Just as a cow may be freely bought and sold in the marketplace, remains dependent upon the will of her master in the matters of activity and maintenance, similarly the surrendered devotee remains fully dependent upon the will of Sri Krishna and simply desires whatever Krishna desires. This theme is echoed in the words of the Srimad Bhagavatam 9:4, 19-20. Now, where have we read that? That's Ambarish Maharaj, huh? So here we go, we've come a full circle. Who knew? Maharaj Ambarish always engaged his mind in taking shelter at the lotus feet of the word, and of course it describes that whole verse as we've just read. In this way he engaged his senses and his transcendent loving propensities completely in the Lord's service. So here... he has given this example of Ambarish Maharaj with the cow example, which is more in line with Saranagati, with relationship to, you know, Ambarish Maharaj. So he's ruling his kingdom, but really his personal life is just serving Krishna. Just, you know, and he understands that everything will be, you know, done by that. That's his only business, serve Krishna. He is given the example as that cow example, that, you know, they're just completely surrendered to the will of the master, which is a Saranagati example, like that. So as you're answering your question, yes, this is coming from Shastra. I am a surrendered soul to Krishna.
So is it the process by which one learns how to surrender, or is it the perfection?
As we were saying, that, you know, one who has achieved Saranagati, their mood is that I am fully surrendered soul to Krishna, the one who has achieved Saranagati. Or we can practice, to come to that point by practicing items of Saranagati. In this, purport, we saw that Prabhupada said from the very beginning, he quotes Bhagavad Gita 7:1, one must understand Krishna by taking shelter of Krishna or his representative. Right? So in order to understand Krishna, we must surrender to Krishna and surrender all our senses in devotional service to Krishna. So what is surrendering something to Krishna? How do we think? How do we act? They are summed up in those six items there, and that's the nectar of instruction, right? Nectar of instruction, the six items of Saranagati. is that what it is? Nectar of instruction? Six things favourable to devotional service, six things unfavourable. Yeah. So, therefore, we wouldn't even know what those six things are. You know, if we're saying, so you've got to surrender everything using all your senses to surrender everything in service to Krishna. So, what is the essence? How do you think? How do you do that? And so, basically, we learn from devotees who are doing it, and they've summarized it into six. And they get these summaries from the Srimad Bhagavatam and such scriptures. That's where these six items come, because we've taken it from people like Bali Maharaj and Ambarish, and they've summarized the main principles of what they saw there into six items, and that's where we get the nectar of instruction from the Bhagavatam, the Chaitanya. And what is that? Everything, we should accept everything favorable for devotional service, reject anything unfavorable. If it's not favorable for devotional service, we've got to get rid of it. We can't expect to progress in Saranagati if we hang on to something which is not favourable. We've got to do that. One may think, I just developed my love for Krishna. What's it got to do with anything else? It comes from the heart. That's what people think, right? When it comes to love, it's just here. There's nothing external. No. Just like people have marriage problems, there's something external affecting their marriage. And they're loving, like, okay, that's got to get, you've got to get rid of that external thing, it's causing a problem. So, but people don't think, they think, it shouldn't be about the externals, it should be coming from the heart. No. You accept what's favourable, you reject what's unfavourable. And then there's got to be that, understanding of Krishna, who's God, that he will protect us, he will maintain us. And because he's going to protect us and maintain us, we should literally, just follow his will without any reservation. That what he wants is going to be the best. That is the best protection, the best maintenance, and will be the most loved. And because he's God, although we're engaged in a loving reciprocation, still, I'm the meek and humble one. You know, although, you know, even Krishna treats me as a, you know, allows me to, by his grace, he puts Arjun in the superior position.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'll be your chariot driver. But, you know, he's called a tutor, you know, because you never fail in your friendship. You know, you're here as my chariot driver because you're God, you're a tutor. In this way, you become a person with Atmanivedanam. You become a person qualified to be considered a fully surrendered soul, Atmanivedanam. Saranagati, by practicing the items of Saranagati. And those items of Saranagati are six. So when we practice them, it's like practicing love without the love actually being there in the very beginning of a marriage. But without practicing the items of love, you can't practice hatred, you can't practice jealousy, you can't practice diplomacy, you can't practice economics. To develop love, you've got to practice love, even though it's not there. Practice the items of love. Like that. So both are correct, yeah.
Why did you say that? I mean, because one of the six items is surrendering everything to the Lord.
Yeah.
So then why do we say that? Why do we call the distinction between Atmanivedanam and Sharanagati? Why don't we just say that Atmanivedanam is one of the six items of Sharanagati?
Say that again.
One of the six items
yeah.
is surrendering everything to the Lord.
Yeah.
So then why don't we say that Atmanivedanam is one of the six items in Sharanagati?
It is.
Because I think you're comparing Bali Maharaj and Ambarish Maharaj.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that what you're saying is that Bali Maharaj was performing one of the six items of Sharanagati, but Ambarish Maharaj had something more because he felt completely dependent on the Lord in every way. So is that what you're saying?
No. Basically, to practice Saranagati or surrender, one of the items that you must do at some stage is practice surrender itself. So we can accept everything favorable for the day that I will try and surrender to the Lord. We can reject everything unfavorable for the day that I try and surrender to the Lord. We can be confident that in the meantime we're going to be looked after and protected when we're waiting for the day that I surrender it to the Lord. And after doing all that, at some stage you've got to surrender to the Lord. and keep oneself in a very meek and humble position. So, you know, to practice love, you actually at some stage have to love, you know. So to practice Saranagati, you do have to surrender. And when it becomes very mature and intimate, it is Saranagati.
So I remember that prayer from Prabhupada when he was on Jaldut, saying, you know, I can't do anything myself. If you write the prayer to the Lord, then, you know, I'm just a puppet, you make me dance.
Yes, Prabhupada, that's right.
I may not be able to speak and they will not understand whatever I say.
You've brought me for some reason, so you must have some desire. So he just wanted to fulfill the, you know, the Lord's desire. That's right, yeah. So that's a very nice prayer, again, in that Saranagati. A completely surrendered soul.
Derive conclusion that surrender in its preliminary state is Atmanivedanam, and surrender in its matured state is Saranagati.
Yeah.
Can we derive that?
Yeah, it is considered that the Daicharas say it is a more intimate stage of the same thing. Yeah.
And that is why it is a gateway through Sharanagati.
Atmanavedanam, yeah, Atmanavedanam is, well, what you were saying, that Burijan Prabhu was saying, that Saranagati is a gateway to Atmanavedanam, which is a limb of devotional service, yeah.
So it makes sense that Saranagati, its preliminary state is Atmanavedanam, its mature state is Saranagati.
Yeah.
See, and what, still it is through Saranagati that one takes a preliminary step too.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
Without Saranagati.
That's when you accept and reject what is available and start practicing
on
it. Yes. You're really sort of trying to just go with the will of the Lord in everything that happens in a meek and humble way, in a very confident way. So you're trying to, you know, always think in those terms.
Oh, sorry, bro. To put it in a different, better way, Saranagati in its preliminary state is Atmanivedana. Saranagati in a matured state is Saranagati itself, which is the ultimate means.
Yeah, yeah. Mm.
So like chanting means an end.
Mm. Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Because devotion. Is it Prabhu?
Yeah, it is the means and the end. Right, it's the process and the goal. The process and the goal is absolute on the spiritual platform.
That is why Ambarish Maharaj is more mature in the sense that he has passed that gateway and he's still, you know.
Yes. There's a more intimacy because of the Dasya Rasa. Plus the Atmanavedanam is there. There's more intimacy because of the Dasya Rasa, and that allows that Saranagati mood as well. Now, while we're here, let's look at Sakyam Atmanavedanam. Just while we're here, we may as well just finish a last little. There's a nice understanding that goes with this as well. Here's a quote from discussing Sakyam Atmanavedanam from Srimad Bhagavatam 4.28.30 purport. The word Yavishyaha indicates that these processes are very powerful. After a devotee engages in the processes of Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu Smaranam, Padasevanam, Archanam, Vandanam, Dasyam, and is able to secure these processes, he can later become a devotee capable of rendering spontaneous devotional service, namely Sakyam and Atmanavedanam. Generally, the great acharyas who preach devotional service all over the world belong to the category of Sakyam Atmanavedanam. A neophyte devotee cannot actually become a preacher. The neophyte is advised to execute devotional service in the seven other fields, Shravanam, Kirtanam, etc. If one can successfully execute the preliminary seven items, he can in the future be situated on the platform of Sakyam Atmanavedanam. Now, there is described that, you know, for preachers, that they are situated on this Sakyam Atmanavedanam, and that this is within the realms of spontaneous devotional service. So, generally, we know that there are two processes. Pancharatriki Vidhi and Bhagavat Bhagavat Marg. The Bhagavat Marg is Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu Smaranam. And the other items are all considered Pancharatriki Vidhi, including Sakyam Atmanavedanam. But Sakyam Atmanavedanam, although they're Pancharatrika Vidhi, they're in the realms of Raga Marga.
Prabhu. Can you repeat the last line?
Yes.
The last sentence.
So, the Bhagavat Vidhi is Bhagavat Bhaga is Shravanam Kirtanam Vishnu Smaranam. The other process is a Pancharatrika Vidhi, the other nine of the nine, so the six. But whereas, but the Sakyam Atmanivedanam, they're on the platform of Raga Marga or spontaneous devotional service, even though they're considered Pancharatrika Vidhi. But so in other words, the Acharya establishing temples for the neophyte disciples to worship the Lord and practice, he's executing the items of Pancharatrika Vidhi, but on the platform of Raga Marga, as a fully surrendered soul, spontaneously serving the Lord, and completely surrendered to the Lord's will. So generally the Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu Smaranam, they're our primary activities. Because the Bhagavat Marg, which is presented by Lord Chaitanya as the way of devotional service of the Brajabasis, spontaneous devotional service. And that Bhagavat Marg is what the Brajabasis do, is that they're engaged in Shravanam, Kirtanam, Smaranam, primarily. And so those activities are our main business because they're very conducive to the activities of the Brajabasis and following in their footsteps and attaining this spontaneous devotional service of Raga Marga. Huh? Still, the Acharyas also keeping all the disciples engaged, all their senses, like Maharaj Ambarish, the legs in walking to the temple, the eyes in seeing the deities, the tongue in eating the prasadam. So they're engaging everyone also in deity worship, which is a Pancharatrika, in offering prayers and chanting mantras and padasevanam and so many things, and rendering so many different types of service and putting on festivals and things like that. So they're engaging the service, but as preachers. And therefore, they're performing those Pancharatrika Vidhi activities on the Raga Marga platform of Sakyam Atmanivedanam. So, yeah, I just thought I'd let you know that. Because sometimes you it's stated that there's apart from the Shravan Kirtan and Vishnu Smaranam, the others are Pancharatrika Vidhi, and one may think that they're on the Vaidhi platform. Because Pancharatrika Vidhi is generally considered Vaidhi platform. And Bhagavat Marga is generally considered Raga Marga. But just to note that those Atmanivedanam, Sakyam Atmanivedanam, although the Pancharatrika Vidhi, they are Raga Marga. Because they're done on the platform of, preachers fully dedicated to the service of the Lord, spreading Krishna consciousness. Yeah?
So those are opening new temples. It's called new temples.
Yeah.
Because Maharaj, whoever is taking a lead step in opening temples, they should be on the Sakyam.
Yeah, as Prabhupada says, actually a neophyte can't preach. I've quoted a few times that not everyone can preach, because I've heard Prabhupada say it. Prabhupada wants everyone to preach, but that doesn't mean everyone can preach. They're not all ready yet. Everyone should preach if they're qualified, and they should try to become qualified, but not everyone can preach. And certainly, if one's not on the platform of Sakyam Atmanivedanam and Saranagati, they can't do what Srila Prabhupada did or Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakura. So, And as we said before, that, you know, in opening temples, you know, we don't do anything just for prestige, or, you know, that, oh, they open a temple, or, you know, yeah, look how much attention they're getting, I'm going to open a temple. Because anything done like that can be a waste of time and money. The Lord reciprocates with one's devotion and purity and surrender. So I'll just leave you with this because, again, just bring it back to Ambarish Maharaj. Now, here's... now, Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu says this, that friendship and offering the self and body are rare because of the difficulty of execution during the state of sadhana. Right, so, sakyam apnavedanam, Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu is saying they're difficult because they're rare because of the difficulty of executing during the stage of sadhana. However, some wise men have considered that these two qualify as part of sadhana. Right, so, Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu is saying that really, sakyam apnavedanam, very difficult to execute if one's, you know, a practicing devotee, you know, rather than a siddha bhakta. But still, Rupa Goswami says that some consider that they are part of sadhana. Sakyam apnavedanam. As we were just discussing here, right? Saranagati, six principles of Saranagati are favourable to developing full surrender. So they're principles within sadhana. But actually, while we're on the platform of sadhana bhakti, not ultima bhakti, where we've, you know, then really they're very hard. It's almost untenable that they'll be done properly on that platform. So they're part of sadhana, but to actually be a fully surrendered soul and a practicing devotee, you know, don't go hand in hand, you know, too easily, and you know. So that's what we're talking about there, right? So that's from Nectar Devotion there, just saying that, you know, the Sakyam Atmanavedanam, the activities of Acharyas, they're on that platform. And some are saying it's also, they're acceptable to be considered on the platform of sadhana. Saranagati, six principles of surrender. You practice them, but really that we practice to surrender, that fifth item, but will we ever do it until we get off the practicing point, we become a really mature, you know, transcendental, then we probably actually do that. So, and his commentary, Jiva Goswami's commentary on that is this. Atmanavedanam in its pure form is rare because of the difficulty in execution, not because of having an elevated status, since it may be executed even without bhava. So he's agreeing. Sakya is rare because of the difficulty in execution and its extremely elevated status, since Sakya in its pure form possesses the most elevated bhava. So for two reasons, Sakya is more rare. However, if Atmanavedanam becomes mixed with emotional relationships, it will become rare because of its elevated status as well. Pure Atmanavedanam is seen in Bali Maharaj when he gave himself to the Lord. Saranapati is acceptance of the Lord as one's protector, as a predominant factor But Atmanivedanam is making oneself the possession of the Lord. Right, so Atmanivedanam, making oneself and everything one owns the possession of the Lord. Saranapati or Saranagati is accepting the Lord as one's protector. That's a prominent feature of that. This is the distinction between the two. So that's a very major distinction there. Atmanivedanam mixed with the emotions of Dasya is seen in Ambarish. This is stated in Bhagavatam, starting with Savai Manaha Krishna Padara Vindayal and ending with Kamamcha Dasya Natu Kamakamyaya. Well, that's Srimad Bhagavatam 9:4, 18-20, which we just read. This mixed Atmanivedanam is also stated later in the 11th canto with Dasyen Atmanivedanam. One should give oneself to me as a servant. That's from the 11th canto, 11th chapter, text 35. The bhava of a dear lover mixed with Atmanivedanam is seen in Rukmini. And this is a quote from Bhagavatam 10:52-39. Therefore, my dear Lord, I have chosen you as my husband and I surrender myself to you at Mapita. Please come swiftly, O mighty, almighty one, and make me your wife. In addition, it should be understood that Sakya and other rasas could also mix with Atmanivedanam. Yep. All right, does that clear up those matters? Good. A little bit technical, but still, it does help us to, you know, see that we're the different levels of devotees. And of course, you know, when we read things like the Brihad Bhagavatam Rita and books like that, they make a lot more sense to us how we can, you know, we can. And this is what I was saying, you know, even over the years, that a devotee properly trained in understanding the Srimad Bhagavatam, Chaitanya Charitamrita, they should be able to recognize very clearly a devotee's level of consciousness and devotional service. You know, the distinguishing characteristics are there, and you know, one should, as one progresses in the understanding and the practice of devotional service, one should be able to recognize within oneself and with others, you know, literally exactly where one is situated in devotional service. It's not, you know, it's not one size fits all in ISKCON. You know? And it is these sort of qualifications that we're looking at. It's not one's external position. It's not how long one has been a devotee. It's not one whether one is male or female, whether one is sannyas, grihastha, brahmacharya. None of these things, these are not mentioned. You know, it is a state of the heart and a way of executing devotional service that distinguishes one devotee from another, and we have to learn to properly recognize. Otherwise, one, we cheat ourselves and we become cheated by others. We become cheated by others in this sense that we can be misled to not associate with devotees who are very we should be taking association with, and we can be misled to associate with persons whose association is perhaps you know, not as required as what is being made out. So we can be cheated in, and that can hamper our devotional service very, very significantly. So, all right, so let's go on again with our, let's turn this off. We finish with that now. So there's about, I had about 35 pages in that document. We got through about a third of it. But just give us a little taste anyway.
What were you reading from
Nectar? I was reading from my notes. I summarise.
Okay.
Yeah. I try and keep a document, you know, if there's this topic, I've got a document on it, you know. That's a topic. What's the difference between Atmanabhata and Saranagati? That's a lovely topic. So, you know, I'll make a document. And I, over many years, you know, I sort of compile these and that. So, and, but there's a lot more to that. There's we could spend, you know, we could spend 3 or 4 classes on that, or you know, 3 months, couldn't we, Driva? But we'll cap it there. No, yeah. Right there. Okay, so in the sacrifice arranged by Maharaj Ambarish, the members of the assembly and the priests, especially the Hota, Udgata, Brahma, and Advaryu, were gorgeously dressed, and they all looked exactly like demigods. They eagerly sought to the proper performance of the jagya. Yeah, yeah, so I should dress up a little bit more when I do my ceremonies. Sometimes I get a little bit better. I like to dress up when I do a jagya. But then, you know, I sort of step out in the courtyard and I feel like, oh God, and people think I'm trying to, you know, bring attention to myself. But I actually like to really dress up for a jagya. But you know, the fancy clothes. I might start doing that again. But it says here, they all look dressed gorgeously, like looking like demigods. But it does attract people. You know, people like it. They, you know, they like to know that their priest, oh, that's that priest over there, all the gear on over there. It gives them a bit of confidence. The citizens of the state of Maharaj Ambarish were accustomed to chanting and hearing about the glorious activities of the personality of Godhead. Thus, they never aspired to be elevated to the heavenly planets, which are extremely dear even to the demigods. Yeah, so you can see that, you know, this is their activities and even his citizens, you know, Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu Smaranam, you know, this Bhagavat Marg. And these verses here expressing this Saranagati that from Bhagavatam 6.17.28, devotees solely engaged in the devotional service of the Supreme Personality of God in Narayan never fear any condition of life. The heavenly planets, liberation, the heavenly planets are all the same to a devotee. A devotee is always situated in the spiritual world. He does not desire anything. He is known as akama or desireless, because he has nothing to desire except to render transcendental loving service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And he trained his citizens in the same way. So, you know, in discussions with devotees, especially when there are, you know, difficulties or, you know, trying circumstances, you can definitely hear you know, and perceive within the disposition of a devotee, even in great difficulties, you know, whether the how much Saranagati, you know, is there, you know, that they're maturing in by their confidence in Krishna's protection despite all things, or those, you know, who are not confident, they're very worried, you know, about, you know, what will happen and so many things. You can hear quite clearly, you know, that when you talk to devotees as they go through different situations in life. Those who are saturated with the transcendental happiness of rendering service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead are uninterested even in the achievements of great mystics, for such achievements do not enhance the transcendental bliss felt by a devotee who always thinks of Krishna within the core of his heart. So the pure devotee is uninterested not only in elevation of the higher planetary systems, but even in the perfections of mystic yogi. So, says, a devotee's senses are not attracted by material enjoyment, and even though the material world is full of misery, the devotee considers this material world to be also spiritual because everything is engaged in the service of the Lord. The difference between the spiritual and world and material world is a mentality of service. When there is a mentality of service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, one's activities are material. Nice definition. There was that devotee of, disciple of Ramanujacharya, and he had his eyes plucked out, tortured by the cruel king. And after receiving the blessings of the Lord, only because he was forced to get those blessings by his spiritual master, because he didn't want to ask for anything for himself, he said, I used to perceive this material world as a place of suffering and misery, and now everywhere I look, I only see your mercy. Like that. The king of this planet, Maharaj Ambarish, just performed devotional service to the Lord, and in this endeavor practiced severe austerity, always satisfying the Supreme Personality of Godhead. By his constitutional activities, he gradually gave up all material desire. So, we want to try and practice these same things. We want to understand that, this is something, that should be stronger in me, that sense of confidence and in Krishna. So next time I'm in a situation and, I am fearful and anxiety, I have to, stop and try and do what Maharaj Ambarish did and just be confident. Everything is fine. I'll just go on with my service and my usual duties, and Krishna will maintain me. We have to practice that. We note it when it's not there, we try and increase it. So he was the king of this planet, and yet he's practicing very severe austerities, giving up all material desires. The Prabhupada says that severe austerities in the practice of devotional service are many varieties, such as worshipping the deities. I saw when I got to the temple today, people busily cleaning everything. That's austerity. Cooking, everything, keeping everything punctual and clean and first class. That takes a lot of austerities. Hard labour involved in preaching and preparing literature, preaching to atheistic men, and distributing literature door to door is often, of course, an austerity. So such austerity is necessary. But by such austerity and devotional service, one is purified of material existence. Indeed, such austerity leads one to the constitutional position of devotional service. In this way, one can give up material desires, and as soon as one is free from material desires, he's free from the repetition of birth, death, old age, and disease. So the difficulties of the engage in performing different aspects of devotional service, they purify us of material existence. And that leads one to the constitutional position of being situated in devotional service. So that's called accepting everything favourable to devotional service. That if those, even accepting difficult services, performing that austerity. To perform that austerity means that we practice. Austerity is of the mind, the speech, and our actions, our work, isn't it? Our mind, is our words, and our activities, our bodies. So that's mentioned in the 17th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. So, you know, austerity of the speech is, you know, we should speak truthfully and pleasingly and regularly recite scriptures like that. Austerity of the body, you know, we should, you know, regularly be respectful to, you know, senior persons and the personality of Godhead, etc. You know, these different forms of austerity means that we have to control the mind and senses from wanting to do some activity based upon our personal sense pleasure, but instead we refrain from that. We control the mind and senses, and we instead do the positive, which are things which are our duty that we must do. You know, that's just, so we practice that, and gradually we become, you know, free from acting for sense gratification. And the austerity is, no, I'll only act for what I should be acting for. And gradually that fixes as that I'll only act for Krishna, I'll only act in devotional service. And then it becomes a natural flow to do that. If we can't perform that austerity, then we can never drag ourselves away from material existence. So it purifies us of material existence by its control and material urges, and that keeps us away from material existence. But there's a positive duty, but I must do this positive engagement, although it's difficult and I'm missing out on sense gratification. That austerity takes me to devotional service like that. So that's how it works. So sometimes, of course, excuse me, there's a remnants of being a bit ill last week. I'm surprised I got through a whole talk today. My wife said, "You'll never get through the whole talk today." But I'm almost there. I was very, very ill, and I couldn't give my class on Thursday. I think it's about once every 10 years I'll give up. You know, I'll not turn up for my class. You know. So I had to call up and say someone else has to do it. I got so sick that I couldn't breathe. I got an infection in the chest. And, So Maharaj Ambarish gave up all attachment to household affairs, wives, children, friends and relatives, to the best of powerful elephants, to beautiful chariots, carts, horses, and inexhaustible jewels, and to ornaments, garments, and an inexhaustible treasury. He gave up attachment to all of them, regarding them as temporary and material. So, here, material possessions can be accepted as far as they can be used in devotional service. So this is this principle of accepting things favourable and rejecting. In preaching, many things considered material are needed. A devotee should not have any attachment for such material involvements as house, wife, children, friends and cars. Maharaj Ambarish, for example, had all such things, but he was not attached to them. This is the effect of bhakti. One who has advanced in devotional service has no attachment for material things for sense enjoyment, but for preaching, to spread the glories of the Lord, he accepts such things without attachment. Everything can be used to the extent that it can be engaged in Krishna's service. So Krishna says the same thing in the Gita. One should not be, you know, attached to wife and children and home. And anyone here in that position? Got wife, children, husband, home? Okay. So we shouldn't be attached to those. But we have to understand that in its proper perspective, that the devotee is only attached to the service of Krishna, and one time I said to my spiritual master that I said I really feel like I could I'd like to do a lot more service to Krishna, but, you know, because I have, you know, at that stage, 4 children, just the 1 wife, and a lot of family, I said, I feel like I can't do as much devotional service as I'd like to. He said, Gangeshwar, that is your devotional service. And he said, if your sadhana is paka, good, you see everything in its relationship to Krishna. Whether you're doing your devotional service for with your family, looking after your family, or the temple or preaching. If your sadhana becomes slackened, then you'll not see its connection with Krishna. So devotees have to be very mindful that they're, you know, many times, you know, Prabhupada, different letters and in lectures, he described that when we bring these children into this movement, they're very special souls that have taken birth, taken shelter, and it's very, very important that we look after them and guide them in devotional service, you know. And that is our devotional service. So devotees, it is this type of statement which is probably one of the most misunderstood statements in ISKCON. And as I said, myself, there was remnants of that in the way I asked that question of my spiritual master, and he just gave a very frank and good understanding. In fact, you know, when I took reinitiation from my Guru Maharaj, he said to me, chant nice rounds, hear my lectures, look after the deities, look after the devotees, look after your family, become a pure devotee and go back to Godhead. So, you know, one of the principal services he gave me, you look after that, that's your devotional service, you know, that's part of your devotion. You're looking after your family, that is, you know, the devotion, one of the devotional services I'm asking you to do, like that. And so, you know, there's no question of being detached. You know, we can detach ourselves from the concept that they are there for my sense gratification. We can be detached from the illusory nature that somehow this is eternally my wife and children. You know, these are spirit souls in my last life, you know. I could have been their mother, you know, their grandmother, you know, I could have been their pet. I don't know. But there's an illusory sort of temporary nature to it, which we don't become attached to because it's going to be smashed to pieces by time. So we're certainly not attached to that material conception of who these spirit souls are. But we're 100% attached that if Krishna wants us, that this is your service to me, to look after these family members who are your devotees, or the family members who are not devotees but who are somehow supporting, you know, looking after these devotees, look after all of them, then if Krishna wants that, if the spiritual master wants that, then there's no sense of detachment there. We're fully attached to that service, fully committed, heart and soul. You know, we perform that service with all our hearts, you know, with full love and devotion. You know? And one should be very, very careful of the tendency for dry renunciation to kick in, especially there. It's very easy for devotees sometimes to become detached from things that cause them trouble. So, you know, Family life in Kali Yuga is known to be very difficult, and therefore one, you know, is considered that unless one, you know, if one can look after, you know, husband, wife, and a few kids and a pet, one is considered very expert, very difficult. A lot of trouble to do that in Kali Yuga, a lot of trouble. So, oh yeah, so much trouble. I'm detached from that. I'm so detached, you know, like that. Because, but if something is a source of great, you know, sense gratification, then very hard to, you know. So, you know, quite often, therefore, family is a way where devotees, when they're experiencing the struggle of maintaining family life, one, they don't want to admit that they're suffering in the material world or that they're not always the transcendentally blissful devotee that they make out to be, or that they have no control over their, you know, people who are, you know, 3-year-old children who, or 5-year-old kids who have more control over them. They're the big Prabhu who can't control a 5-year-old. And that their sense gratification in family life has, infringed upon, and therefore they're actually frustrated and angry and suffering from tamagun. So therefore they like to cover all that over with this veneer of, I'm just so detached from it, I'm just not really interested in family life, you know. Wife, kids, home, it's nothing to me, I'm never there, you know. So, you know, Srila Gaurakishore Das Babaji considered that sort of false renunciation, you know, that sort of detachment from things that are related is, he says, it's a testament to our lack of bhakti. But in ISKCON, and this is what we're saying, it's that sometimes we have to learn what are the symptoms of an advanced devotee. You know, it's that mood of saranagati. The whole process is a process of surrender. And, it's not, but quite often one is seen as how advanced they are by how detached they are from their family. But that's, you know, can be very, very misleading as to, you know, what brought on that detachment. You know, is it sour grapes? Is it spiritual advancement or is it sour grapes? Being very pleased by the unalloyed devotion of Maharaj Ambarish, the Supreme Personality of Godhead gave the king his disc, which is fearful to enemies and which always protects the devotee from enemies and adversities. A devotee, purport, being always engaged in the service of the Lord, may not be expert in self-defense, but because a devotee fully depends on the lotus feet of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he is always sure of protection by the Lord. Prahlad Maharaj said, 7943, a devotee is always merged in the ocean of transcendental bliss of rendering service to the Lord. Therefore, he is not at all afraid of any adverse situation in the material world. The Lord also promises, O Arjun, you may declare to the world that the devotees of the Lord are never vanquished. For the protection of the devotees, Krishna's disc, the Sudarshan Chakra, is always ready. And we heard last week that Balaram's club, always ready as well. Mm-hmm. When he wants it, then, Sumantra, what's his servant's name? Something like that, who resides in Talatala Loka. He immediately brings, if Balaram wants his club to protect his devotee, then he brings that club or his plough all the way from Talatala Loka. This disc is extremely fearful to the non-devotees. Therefore, although Maharaj Ambarish is fully engaged in devotional service, his kingdom is free of all fear and adversity. Fearful, yeah. So, to worship Lord Krishna, Maharaj Ambarish, along with his queen, who is equally qualified, observed the vow of a codicy and dwadasi for 1 year. So this is the story, then, of Devasa Muni. So So they absorb this, observe this power. So basically in this purport we see that he's very detached, but there's no need for him to leave his home because his wife's an equally qualified devotee. In the month of and therefore he's executing his devotional service with her. In the month of Kartika, after observing that vow for 1 year, so therefore, you know, here we see this example of Dvasa. So he's not attached to any material side of his opulences, wife, children, what have you. But that doesn't mean that he's just neglecting them, which is the ISKCON version sometimes, not always, of, you know, detachment. You neglect the wife and children. You know, that's the old ISKCON version. I think it still exists in many parts of the world. But that's... he's performing devotional service for 1 year alongside her. Together. That's detachment.
Why only 1 year? Why not grow?
His wife wanted to go on holiday. No, I'm just... no. It's a 1 year brata, isn't it?
Yeah. Sometimes they do the brata, so it's like a
brata. Yeah. 1 year is a standard time for that. Yeah.
That means it's not following throat ekadasi.
Yeah, each ekadasi and each dvadasi for a year.
Yeah, only for 1 year, Prabhu. Then later on, after that?
Yeah, but this is an ekadasi dvadasi brata, which means that there are extra things. They're dedicating themselves that, you know, on these days, for instance, you know, for us on a codicil, we don't have grains, etc., but we just about do everything else. We go for a walk in the park, this and that. You know, their codicil and dvadasi is like just full worship from, you know, 24. They probably don't sleep. They're just, you know, serving. It's, you know, it's a brata. It's 24 hours, you know. And you know, it goes, and that's the, you know, the dvadasi, the ekadasi, the dvadasi, it's, you know, those 2 days, very, very strict. And as you see, to break his fast, that means no water, you know, it sounds like no water, no, or anything on the ekadasi. And Prabhupada says, you know, one time someone asked Prabhupada, what does ekadasi mean? He says, no food, no water, that's ekadasi, you know. 24 hours chanting. So, but they would break it on the Dvadasi, but very, you know, strict activities of worship and everything in breaking it. In the month of Kartika, after observing that vow for 1 year, after observing a fast for 3 nights, and after bathing in the Jamuna, Maharaj Ambarish worshipped the Supreme Person of Godhead, Hari, in Madhuvan. Following the regular principles of Mahabhishek, Maharaj Ambarish performed the bathing ceremony for the deity of Lord Krishna with all paraphernalia, and then he dressed the deity with fine clothing, ornaments, fragrant flowers, garlands, and other paraphernalia for worship of the Lord. With attention and devotion, he worshipped Krishna and all the greatly fortunate Brahmanas who were free from all material desires. Thereafter, Maharaj Ambarish satisfied all the guests who arrived at his house, especially the Brahmanas. He gave in charity 60 crores of cows whose horns were covered with gold plate and whose hoofs were covered with silver plate. All the cows were well decorated with garments and had full milk bags. They were mild-natured, young and beautiful, and were accompanied by the calves. After giving these cows, the king first sumptuously fed all the Brahmanas, and then they were fully satisfied. He was about to observe the end of Kodashi, with their permission, by breaking the fast exactly at that time. However, Dvasa Muni, the great and powerful mystic, appeared on the scene as an uninvited guest. My wife says to me when we're reading this, she goes, he does that a lot, doesn't he? You know, he just turns up as an uninvited guest with all these other different people. He does. After standing up to receive Devasa Muni, King Ambarish offered him a seat and paraphernalia of worship. Then, sitting at his feet, the king requested the great sage to eat. Devasa Muni gladly accepted the request of Maharaj Ambarish, but to perform the regular ritualistic ceremonies, he went to the river Jamuna. There he dipped into the water of the auspicious Jamuna and meditated upon the impersonal Brahman. In the meantime, now that could take a long time, meditating on the impersonal Brahman. He could be there for a while. In the meantime, only a Muhurta of the Dvadasi day was left on which to break the fast. Consequently, it was imperative that the fast be broken immediately. In this dangerous situation, the king consulted learned Brahmanas. The king said, to transgress the laws of respectful behaviour toward the Brahmanas is certainly a great offence. On the other hand, if one does not observe the breaking of the fast within the time of Dvadasi, there is a flaw in one's observance of the vow. Therefore, O Brahmanas, if you think that it will be auspicious and not irreligious, I shall break the fast by drinking water. In this way, after consulting with the Brahmanas, the king reached this decision. For according to Brahminical opinion, drinking water may be accepted as eating and also not eating. So he consulted with the Brahmanas, but ultimately he decided himself that this was the best course of action. And that they agreed. Our best of the Kuru dynasty, after he drank some water, King Ambarish, meditating upon the Supreme Personality of God within his heart, waited for the return of the great mystic Devasa Muni. After executing the ritualistic ceremonies to be performed at noon, Devasa returned from the bank of the Jamuna. The king received him well, offering all respects, but Devasa Muni, by his mystic power, could understand that King Ambarish had drunk water without his permission. Still hungry, Devasa Muni, his body trembling, his face curved and his eyebrows crooked in a frown, angrily spoke as follows to King Ambarish, who stood before him with folded hands. Alas, just see the behaviour of this cruel man. He is not a devotee of Lord Vishnu. Being proud of his material opulence and his position, he considers himself God. Just see how he's transgressed the laws of religion. So if you read this purport, you see how Vishwanath Chakravarti, the court, he shows us how that, if you look at those words, you never really have to hear a criticism of Maharaj Ambarish. You can, accidentally, Devasa Muni, without knowing it, inadvertently praised him, although he's intending, and devotees only hear that aspect. Devotees don't like to hear the fault of a pure devotee. So Vishwanath Chakravarti, the core, saves us from that dilemma. Maharaj Ambarish, you have invited me to eat as a guest, but instead of feeding me, you yourself have eaten first. Because of your misbehavior, I shall show you something to punish you. As Devasa Muni said this, his face became red with anger. Uprooting a bunch of hair from his head, he created a demon resembling the blazing fire of devastation to punish Maharaj Ambarish. Wouldn't you love to be able to do that every now and then? You kids not going to eat your dinner? Taking a trident in his hand and making the surface of the earth tremble with his footsteps, that blazing creature came before Maharaj Ambarish. But the king, upon seeing him, was not at all disturbed, and he did not move even slightly from his position. There's that verse again quoted, Narayana Para Savina Katastina Bibhyati. Never afraid of any material danger. As fire in the forest immediately burns to ashes an angry snake, so by the previous order of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, his disc, the Sudarsan Chakra, immediately burnt to ashes the creature, the created demon to protect the Lord's devotee. Mm. Now, yeah, it says here, the Lord, however, knows how to protect his devotees. The Lord knew everything. Therefore, before anything happened, he had already arranged for his chakra to protect Maharaj Ambarish. This protection is offered to a devotee even from the very beginning of his devotional service. And that's why we should practice Saranagati. And even if we're not practicing it in its actual, proper form, but, you know, trying to have some resemblance of it, we still get the benefit. Krishna will still protect us by practicing. Therefore, you know, and that is the absolute nature of bhakti. And that's why we call, you know, that's why bhakti, we consider it like the green mango and the ripe mango. It's still a mango. So even though we're performing, if we're trying to perform the pure devotional service, but in a very neophyte stage, in one sense it's not bhakti proper because it's not mature. But in another sense, it is still bhakti, and it gives the same result, and you get the same protection of the Lord. So when we say it's not bhakti proper, we have to be very careful not to give the impression that you're not going to get the results. Because, you know, time and time again we've seen that, you know, the results are there from the very beginning. Because Krishna is Bhava Graha Janardana. He gives the result for the intention of what you're trying to do. Even though you're not qualified to actually do it. If one simply begins devotional service, he is immediately protected by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. This is also confirmed in Bhagavad Gita 1866. Aham tvam sarva prapabhyo moksha yasyami. Protection begins immediately. The Lord is so kind and merciful that he gives the devotee proper guidance and all protection, and thus the devotee very peacefully makes solid progress in Krishna consciousness without outward disturbances. A serpent may be very angry and ready to bite, but the furious snake is helpless when faced by a blazing fire in the forest. Although an enemy of a devotee may be very strong, he is compared to an angry serpent before the fire of devotional service. Upon seeing that his own attempt had failed and that the Sudarshan Chakra was moving toward him, Devasa Muni became very frightened and began to run in all directions to save his life. As the blazing flames of the forest fire pursue a snake, the disc of the Supreme Personality of Godhead began following Devasa Muni. Devasa Muni saw the disc was almost touching his back, and thus he ran swiftly, desiring to enter a cave of Sumeru Mountain. Just to protect himself, Devasa Muni fled everywhere, in all directions, in the sky, on the surface of the earth, in the caves, in the ocean, on different planets of the rulers of the three worlds, and even on the heavenly planets. But wherever he went, he immediately saw following him the unbearable fire of the Sudarshan Chakra. With a fearful heart, Devasa Muni went here and there, seeking shelter. But when he could find no shelter, he finally approached Lord Brahma and said, "Oh my Lord, O Lord Brahma, kindly protect me from the blazing Sudarshan Chakra sent by the Supreme Personality of Godhead." Lord Brahma said, "At the end of the Dviparadha, that's Brahma's life, when the pastimes of the Lord come to an end, Lord Vishnu, by a flick of his eyebrows, vanquishes the entire universe, including our places of residence. Such personalities as me and Lord Shiva, as well as Daksha, Bhrigu, and similar great saints, of which they are the head, also the rulers of the living entities, the rulers of human society, and the rulers of the demigods, all of us surrender to that Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Vishnu, bowing our heads to carry out his orders for the benefit of all living entities." When Devasa Muni, who was greatly afflicted by the blazing fire of the Sudarshan Chakra, was thus refused by Lord Brahma, he tried to take shelter of Lord Shiva, who always resides on his planet known as Kailash. Lord Shiva said, "My dear son, I, Lord Brahma, and the other demigods who rotate within this universe, under the misconception of our greatness, cannot exhibit any power to compete with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, for innumerable universes and their inhabitants come into existence and are annihilated by the simple direction of the Lord. Past, present, and future are known to me, Lord Shiva, Sanat Kumara, Narada, the most revered Lord Brahma, Kapila, Apantaratmana, that's Vyasadeva, Devala, Yamaraj, Asuri, Maricha, and many saintly persons headed by him, as well as many others who have achieved perfection. Nonetheless, because we are covered by the illusory energy of the Lord, we cannot understand how expansive that illusory energy is. You should simply approach that Supreme Personality of Godhead to get relief, for this Sudarshan Chakra is intolerable even to us. Go to Lord Vishnu. He will certainly be kind enough to bestow all good fortune upon you. Thereafter, being disappointed, even in taking the shelter of the Lord Shiva, the Vasamuni went to Vaikuntha Dham, where the Supreme Personality of Godhead Narayan resides with his consort, the Goddess of Fortune. Devasa Muni, the great mystic, scorched by the heat of the Sudarshan Chakra, fell at the lotus feet of Narayan. His body trembling, he spoke as follows. O infallible, unlimited Lord, protector of the entire universe, you are the only desirable objective for all devotees. I am a great offender, my Lord. Please give me protection. O my Lord, O supreme controller, without knowledge of your unlimited prowess, I have offended your most dear devotee. Very kindly save me from the reaction of this offence. You can do everything, for even if a person is fit for going to hell, you can deliver him simply by awakening within his heart the holy name of your lordship. We'll leave it there. All right? And next week, don't miss the next exciting climactic conclusion as to what the Lord said and did in response. And we hear these essential verses of the Bhagavatam, which are, you know, the very essence of the devotee's love for his devotees. All right, we'll leave that there. And, of course, we'll also read chapter 5 next week, which is a short chapter. We'll finish that and then move on. Thank you very much for coming. So now, next Saturday, right, there's nothing to stop us from giving class unless I... No? So, no, because we've got Balaram on Thursday, so, yeah, he's...
Following week is...
Following week, yeah, so next week we'll be here. Be there or be square. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.